Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Good evening, everybody. Pastor Eli James here, and Pastor Bill Fink with another installment of Yahweh's Covenant People. Tonight is going to be the final installment of the Book of Acts. We've covered 27 chapters, and tonight we're going to be covering the 28th and a recap. But I would like to begin by talking about the archaeological evidence that there is between the Canaanite occupation of Palestine, and I really don't like to call it Palestine, but it doesn't qualify as Judea. In my writings, I tend to refer to it as Canaan land, okay, because it wasn't called Palestine, and Philistia, after which the word Palestine derives, was really only a small area on the coast that actually today would correspond with Gaza, okay? Is that your understanding too, Bill?
Well, Palestine, according to Strabo, goes from basically the border of Egypt all the way to the northern border of Syria.
Okay, so he had
a very wide view of what Palestine was. It included the entire, Gaza, Philistia, Syria, the Tyre and Sidon, and all the way up Byblos, and all the way up to Cilicia,
right.
Practically.
Yeah, but they did not necessarily recognize the cultural distinctions among the various peoples that lived there. So they just use it as a general territorial.
Well, right, and Herodotus actually refers three times to the Judeans.
Okay.
And he's definitely talking about Judah because he mentions the war with one of the pharaohs that happened just several decades before the deportations,
mm-hmm.
with the king of Judah, and he talks about a few things and mentions them and calls them the Syrians of Palestine.
Okay.
That's what he calls the Judeans.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so what I'm going to do now is quote from, I forgot the author's name. This is a book that's been attended to, Young's Analytical Concordance, published in 1936. I've got an original copy of that. And this is Recent Discoveries in Bible Lands by William F. Albright. Okay, William F. Albright. And in his day, was apparently a very famous archaeologist. And I'm quoting here now from page 29. Comparison of the cult objects and mythological texts of the Canaanites with those of the Egyptians and Mesopotamians forces one conclusion, that Canaanite religion was much more completely centered on sex and its manifestations. In no country has so relatively great a number of figurines of the naked goddess of fertility, some distinctly obscene, been found. Nowhere does the cult of serpents appear so strongly. Are you surprised by that, Bill?
Not at all.
Haven't we been saying numerous times that the Canaanites were sex worshippers and that they practiced sex with anything and everything?
Right. I think it's my Broken Cisterns essays that elucidate that all those Baal religions were about sex.
That's right.
They were fertility religions about sex.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so is Judaism.
Well, absolutely. The Judaism is a perversion of the Baal religions mixed into a little bit of Torah and
right.
And it's absolutely polluted. It's no
That's
better.
Right. It's a polluted sex worship, and the Israelites were actually one of the few peoples, and it's probably true of all of the nations of Genesis 10, to a greater or lesser extent, that they didn't practice sex with other races. They probably had cross tribal within the white race, but those who practiced interracial sex, those were people who broke away from the traditions of the white race in the territory, okay? And they probably were at the periphery of Mesopotamia, okay?
Well, we've always had race mixers
at the
periphery in the big cities, and
that's
something that's as old as time.
Yes.
The whole free love movement, though, which started with the Jews in the 1800s as they came into Europe.
Yes.
That is just another manifestation of the same Canaanite religions poisoning the children of Israel.
Right, and the free love movement in 1960s in America.
Yeah, right. Well, that came from the same Jews that had fled Germany in the 30s.
Right, yeah. Again, it was Jewish. You know, that whole 1960s quote-unquote revolution was Jewish-inspired, a Jewish-financed, Jewish-led. There's simply no doubt about it.
But it was Jewish by in every way.
Yeah. And so then he also says here, the cult of serpents. All right. Who was the original serpent in Genesis chapter 3?
Absolutely.
That's what we're talking about here, folks. They're Cain worshipers. They're Nakash worship. They're fallen angels. They're the progeny of the fallen angels. There's simply no doubt about this. So continuing here, the two goddesses Astarte and Anath, and Anath is cognate with Anak, okay, the Anak, Anunnaki, etc., are called the great goddesses which conceive but do not bear. Now that's fascinating. Conceive but do not bear. Maybe that's a reference to conceiving chimeras in their wombs, but they don't get born because they really don't develop to viable offspring.
It might be, you know, abortion is as old as time too.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it could be abortion as well. You know,
we think abortion is a new thing that started with 1960s and our own technology.
Mm-hmm.
Procopius talked about the Emperor Justinian's wife and talked about what kind of a whore she was,
mm-hmm,
before he married her, and how she had sex with 30 men every evening when she was an actress.
Right.
And constantly aborted her pregnancies.
Uh-huh.
And he said it just like that. She terminated her pregnancies, meaning that they had methods of abortion 1,500 years ago.
Right.
And they had them 3,000 years ago.
Yeah, but the most common method in those days was to bear the child and throw it to the fires of Moloch.
Yes, or to expose the child, yes.
Another Canaanite god, yeah.
and even the Greeks were famous for exposing their children.
Uh-huh, yeah, because quite frankly, a lot of Israelites adopted Canaanite religion. And they brought it, they traveled.
Yes, they did.
Yes.
There's no doubt.
They brought it to Ireland and Britain.
They learned it in Egypt with the Canaanite pharaoh that was forcing them to abort to expose their children there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so sacred courtesans and eunuch priests were excessively common. Human sacrifice was well known, though it does not seem to have been practiced quite so frequently as used to be thought. Well, if they're aborting people and they're throwing children into the fires, I guess, you know, sacrificing adults was kind of an afterthought.
now, let me say, I'm not sure of the verity behind it.
Okay.
But that and I don't respect much of his work, but that George Lamza does do a good job with a lot of those Hebrew and Aramaic idioms.
Right, right.
And he asserts that passing your children through the fires of Moloch was actually a reference to giving your children to other races in marriage.
Uh-huh, okay. Yeah, they could have become an idiom for that, yes. Yeah, in either case, the Israelite offspring is destroyed. Yes.
Well, right, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay. And you know, it's even said that where Judah had the Canaanite wife, that Judah married the daughter of a strange god.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, so it's the same sort of reference.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. So we're seeing here that, you know, the basic point to be stressed here is that only the Israelites, of all the people in Mesopotamia, had a rigid rule against interracial sex. Okay? And this kind of racial exclusivity was created by Yahweh to preserve our race. There's simply no doubt about it. Okay? Now, one more sentence here on this paragraph. The aversion felt by the followers of Yahweh God when confronted by Canaanite idolatry is accordingly very easy to understand, okay? So praise Yahweh for this archaeologist really telling it like it is, okay? And obviously, the modern churches of Judeo-Christianity, so-called, have gone bonkers all the way onto the Canaanite side today. They're all race mixers.
It just amazes me that people, I mean, there's a lot of people out there that have read the Old Testament.
Yes.
That have to be able to see the pattern of these Canaanites and these fertility sex rituals and their lives revolving around
yeah.
that. And then you see how the Jews act in society.
Like Paula White and who's the other preacher?
and why don't they see the pattern?
Yeah, they don't, because they don't read the Old Testament.
By their fruits you know them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just ignore all of history and look at how they act, you could tell that they're the Canaanites of ancient
yeah.
times.
Right, right.
They're the children of Canaan.
By their fruits shall you know them. But because the modern Judeo-Christians have become so apologetic and dare not to judge anybody for what they do.
Yeah, apologizing for the devil is what it boils
exactly.
down to.
Exactly. Right.
And refusing to judge the devil.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
just incredible.
It is incredible. It's utterly incredible. Okay, now in the same chapter, he goes on to talk about the archaeology of old Canaan land, okay? At Jericho, Garstang, whoever he is, name not familiar.
He was a famous 18th century, 19th century archaeologist.
Okay. At Jericho, Garstang has proved that there was Canaanite occupation down to the 14th century. He dates its end at the earliest possible point around 1400 B.C., but the writer prefers, that is Albright himself, prefers a date later in the 14th century. And Vincent maintains his original 13th century date. Decisive evidence is still lacking. At Bethel, the writer found that the clearest possible demarcation between Canaanite and Israelite strata, the end of the former occupation he places in the first half of the 13th century, but it could be dated a little higher and conceivably a little lower. At I, which is AI, the excavators have drawn a blank with a large city covering most of the third millennium and a small Israelite village of the 12th and 11th century on the Acropolis, but no occupation in the interval, a period of 1,000 years. There are a number of theories to explain this apparent anomaly. The writer refuses to take the view that the I episode, Joshua 7-8, is legendary. He thinks it's historical, and thinks that there has been a certain interchange of names between the adjacent sites of Bethel and I. And I think this kind of controversy of whether they have actually found I or Bethel and got the two confused, and that's probably still the case today. Anyway, only 2 miles apart, so that the Canaanite Eye has been brought to light by the excavations at Bethel. So Albright thinks that the two have been confused, and so that the Eye has actually been found, falsely labeled as Bethel. Anyway, one more paragraph here. Turning to the Shephelah of Judah, there are two sites of particular value to us, both certainly Canaanite royal cities, Lachish and Tel Bet Mirsim, probably Debir or Kiriath Sefer. At Lachish, the excavators have not yet reached the Canaanite strata inside the wall, but outside they have cleared 3 superimposed Canaanite sanctuaries, the latest of which belongs to the first half of the 13th century, as shown clearly by their rich inventory. The fall of Lachish into the hands of the Israelites then presumably took place somewhere about the middle of that century, late in the reign of Ramesses II, 1301 to 1235 B.C. The fall of Canaanite Tel Bet Mirsim, excavated by the writer, also took place somewhere in the 13th century.
And let me just interject something real quick.
Yes.
Most mainstream archaeologists and scholars don't see this because they think the Exodus happened during the reign of Ramses.
Okay, yes.
And not much earlier, as Josephus even states, during the reign of Thutmose.
Okay.
Okay, so go on.
Yeah, very good. Let's see, where was I here? Okay, well, let's see. But Ramses II. With this rough date for the fall of at least 2 of the Canaanite towns of the Shephelah into Israelite hands agrees the first mention of Israel as a people, not as a land, in the Stela of Merneptah, circa 1230 B.C. It should be said in this connection that we now have so much evidence from hieroglyphic and cuneiform sources as well as from archaeological data for the history and condition of Palestine between 1500 and 1250, that no earlier date for the decisive phase of the occupation seems possible unless we are going to surrender the historicity of the Hebrew traditions of the conquest almost entirely. Okay, so, and he rejects that. He says, this is historical. The transition from Canaanite occupation of Palestine to Israelite occupation of Palestine is clearly showed by all the strata of the various towns and cities that have been excavated, and there's simply no doubt about it. It occurred, you know, in the 14th century, primarily in the 14th century B.C., okay? Now, let me
say that I quote in one of my papers, it might be classical records of Dorian and Dan and Greeks, but I'm really not positive.
Okay.
I explain an archaeological finding of Mycenaean graves,
okay,
in Lachish. And they wonder how these Mycenaean graves got into Lachish.
Okay.
And they don't realize that the Mycenaeans were Danans.
Right.
And so were the inhabitants of Lachish,
okay,
after the Danan conquest of Lachish.
So they have falsely identified the Danans as Mycenaean Greeks.
Right. And what they even claim, and some archaeologists have realized the whole Danan connection.
Yeah.
And what they claim, and I've seen this claim written, done, you know, in scholarly archaeological,
yes,
tomes and articles, that the Danans were actually Greeks that came into Palestine and adopted as a tribe by the Hebrews.
Okay.
But, which is absolutely absurd. it flies in the face of all biblical
things. Yeah, right.
The Bible's a lie, and they'll make up their own story because these Danans were obviously white.
Right.
Yeah, you know, and they were obviously Greeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. They have to come up with a convoluted explanation because the assumption is that the Israelites were hook-nosed kikes.
Right.
So what would these hook-nosed kikes be doing adopting Mycenaean Greeks? Okay. Well, the assumption that the Israelites are hook-nosed kikes, that's the false assumption. Yeah, that's the false assumption. But because they simply believe the Jews, that they're Israelites, this is the kind of stuff they come up with.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They have to pervert all of history and archaeology, and
yeah,
they do it to continually maintain that false assumption.
Yeah, yeah. So the only other thing I was going to say is that from all of the reading I've done, the Exodus occurred around 1430 B.C.
Well, yeah, 1450 is
mm-hmm,
you know, the round date I usually use. But.
Okay, and now they're about, so they wandered in the desert for 40 years. Let's take the 1450 date, okay? That brings us to 1410, okay? We're right smack dab in the middle of the era that Albright is talking about.
Right, and 400 years later, David's king, and it's roughly about 1,000.
Yeah, yeah. So how can you place Canaanites, you know, how can you assume the Canaanites are ruling this area when obviously the Israelites have taken it over? They've taken over the area of Tyre and Sidon, okay? They've virtually exterminated all the Canaanites with the exception of those to the far south and those to the far north. And they left some Philistines alive, too, because I don't think the Philistines were actually Canaanites.
Well, the Philistines were, first, they were of Mitzrayim.
Yeah,
according to the Pentateuch, according to Moses.
Okay.
Okay. Now it's and they had many wars with Egypt later on.
Yeah.
But I mean, look at how long it was before we had wars with England. But when we half of the colonists came from England, right?
Right.
And settled in America, and 150 years later, we were having wars with the English.
Right.
So I wouldn't count the wars that the Philistines. A lot of people try to take the wars with the Philistines under the Pharaoh Merneptah and between the Egyptians and the Philistines, and the Philistines are enumerated among the sea peoples, and it can be demonstrated that many of those so-called sea peoples were Israelite tribes, by the way.
Right.
And they actually try to disrelate the Philistines and the Egyptians because of those wars.
Yeah.
But,
okay,
but you know, the Philistines and the Egyptians may have been separated from each other for 1,000 years by that time.
Right, right. Yeah, so essentially the Philistines were Hamites.
Now there's a I believe the Philistines were pure for the most part. Okay. I mean, there's no doubt that they had the Kenites among them.
Right.
And that's the biblical testimony.
Yeah.
And Goliath was not a Philistine. He was actually a Kenite Rephaim mercenary,
right,
in the employ of the Philistines.
Right.
As many of them were.
Yes.
Now, Goliath is not representative of the Philistine race. He's, you know, Chronicles identifies him as a Rephaim.
Right.
Along with his brethren.
The tribe of Gath, exactly. Yes.
Now, the Philistines themselves, I believe, were pure for the most part because of a prophecy of Zechariah where he says that, you know, he states an oracle against the Philistines and says that a bastard shall live in Ashdod.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if there were bastards living in Ashdod, that prophecy wouldn't make any sense whatsoever.
Okay.
And the word is Mamzer, and it's a half-breed.
Yeah.
So he must have been uttering that oracle to a people relatively pure in stock.
Okay, right, right.
Or it makes no sense.
Well, now Ashdod would be in Philistia, okay?
Yes, it was one of the chief, you know, four cities of Philistine.
Okay, and that bastard maybe was Goliath.
Well,
right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's basically telling them that they're all going to be deported too, and they were.
Yeah, it doesn't
and
say that they're all going to be Mamzers.
And a lot of the Israelites, it was spoken of that they would fly on the ships of the Philistines.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. You know, they would escape the Assyrians on the ships of the Philistines.
Right. Now, I would like to briefly discuss Tyre and Sidon, okay, because obviously the Israelites conquered the entire territory, but it's questionable whether they conquered all of Tyre, especially the island, okay?
Well, it shouldn't be questionable that they conquered all of Tyre.
Okay.
Because the records do not leave any Canaanites in Tyre.
Okay.
But the records explicitly state the Canaanites were left in Sidon.
Okay.
However, all of the colonization, and this is from the mouth of the Greeks, all of the Phoenician colonization of the Mediterranean came through Tyre.
Okay.
And that's verbatim from Herodotus, basically, yeah, and not from Sidon.
Yeah. And then the Canaanites were not seafarers in any case. Okay.
I'm sure there were some Canaanite slaves and some Canaanite merchants wherever,
right,
the Israelites went.
Yes.
There's no doubt. But the people that made all those great Phoenician colonies in the Mediterranean,
yeah,
were definitely Israelites.
Yeah. So there's simply no doubt. There's just a major mistake that the academic historians have made and the biblical scholars have made, falsely differentiating between Phoenicians and Israelites.
Right. And in my classical and biblical records identifying the Phoenicians on my website, that there are several citations from the Septuagint that disappeared from the Masoretic text,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
that basically demonstrate that Tyre was an Israelite city.
Okay.
And Josephus claims Tyre as an Israelite,
right,
city. And Herodotus actually stated, and so do several other Greek historians,
yeah,
that the Phoenicians practiced circumcision.
Okay.
Okay. So there's a lot of evidence,
yes,
that the Phoenicians were absolutely
yeah,
Israelites.
And we know that the Druids, they wore Levitical type robes. Okay. So they brought that tradition where the Druids were actually Levites.
Right. If you want the purest, I believe the purest Phoenician stock in Europe today can be found in Ireland.
Okay.
Amongst the,
mm-hmm,
the Irish.
Yeah.
Ireland was settled first by the Tuatha De Danann and then by the Malaysians. And
okay,
the Malaysians were absolutely identified as Phoenicians by the Greeks.
Okay.
And Miletus was a large city in Caria. And Caria was the oldest name, you know, in Greek histories for the southwesternmost district of,
yeah,
of Anatolia. And Cilicia was a Phoenician settlement originally.
Mm-hmm.
And Strabo explains that the Carians and the Cilicians, who were allies of the Trojans during the Trojan Wars with the Danans,
yeah,
that they received their kings from Trojan princes.
Yes.
And the Trojans are Zara Judah.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
So we have clear
and
evidence,
why would Canaanites,
of the scepter of Judah,
yeah,
which idiots like Buddy Johnson can't explain because,
yeah,
they know nothing about history,
right, so
troublemakers.
It begs the question, why would a bunch of Aryans accept hook-nosed kikes as their kings?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
And they were all absolutely Aryan.
Yes. doesn't make any sense. You know, so the problem has been created by the Jews falsely claiming to be Israel, and therefore the world of scholarship simply believing that garbage, therefore is utterly confused and is forced to make up a false history, like saying that the Mycenaean Greeks settled in Israel and were adopted by the hook-nosed kikes, that this is the kind of history they come up with.
Right, and it's a damn shame when so many people in Israel identity who profess to know better, they know nothing,
mm-hmm.
because they repeat all the stupid Jew lies.
Right, because it's amazing, Bill, that very, very few Christians have ever done this research, except, you know, the scholars of British Israel and the scholars of Christian identity. You know, so if you read Howard B. Rand, if you read Swift and Comparay, to some extent Armstrong, you know, but especially the British Israelite historians.
Well, right, and even before, forget even, you know, Edward Hines was a Jew and a joker.
Okay.
And there's much better British historians than that. Read George Rawlinson, Sharon Turner, George Moore. They're the real British Israel historians.
Yeah, well, but yeah, in fact, they're more objective because they really didn't understand, at least Sharon Turner didn't really understand that these people were Israelites. You know, you're
right.
Talking about Aryans. But that's even better because it's objective scholarship that way. You know?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
And James Pritchard, The Eastern Origin of the Celts, and that was written 150 years ago.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great books from the 1800s and the British scholars.
Yeah, Waddell.
L.A. Waddell, right. L.A. Waddell, The Phoenician Origin of the Breton Scots and Anglo-Saxons.
Yeah. Yeah,
and here's how screwed up L.A. Waddell was.
Okay.
He had the whole archaeology thing right.
Yes.
He knew that these people, these early Breton Scots, the Irish, that they originated in the Levant.
Right.
He knew that.
Yeah, he knew the Mesopotamians, yes.
He was so convinced that the Jews were Israel that he tried to turn an inscription that clearly said Gad.
Yes, Gad.
Into Hittite.
Right.
He tried to change the G to a Keth or a Heth.
Right.
And,
he changed the G to a CH.
Yeah, and he changed the D,
mm-hmm.
the Dalet.
Right.
He changed it to a tab. Or
yeah,
I
remember reading that passage where he talks about that inscription. He dates it very precisely. It proves that it was the tribe of Gad, okay? But, yeah, you're right. He's so convinced that the Jews were Israel that he couldn't imagine it was Gad. Yeah.
They had to be Hittites.
It had to be what he perceived to be an Aryan tribe, which he got wrong anyway because the Hittites weren't Aryans.
Right.
Okay.
So he proves the identity story once you straighten out his misidentification
of
the people when they're back in the Levant.
Right. Once you understand his mistakes and the reasoning behind his mistakes, it becomes absolutely clear that he had discovered the tribe of Gad in Britain.
Right, and he's in, you know, he's writing in Oxford in the 20s, and
sure.
He did a lot of excellent work, but he just wouldn't correctly identify the Jews.
Yeah, and that just proves that this false assertion by the Jews that they're Israelites has screwed up the world of scholarship to no end. It has affected linguistics, it has affected history, it has affected archaeology.
Right, Hebrew is Proto-Indo-European, as far as I'm concerned.
That's right, it absolutely is.
They're all looking for a Proto-Indo-European language, and I can prove it's Hebrew.
Yes,
but
well, Welsh is 100% Hebrew. You know, Tyndale said when he translated from Hebrew into English, he didn't have to worry about syntax. He just replaced Hebrew words with English words, and it made perfect sense. Okay? Now, try to do that with any other two languages.
Well, right. You can't do it with Latin, and you can't do it with Greek. I know that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, because those two, their grammar is totally different from either Hebrew or English. That's what he was saying. The grammar between Hebrew and English is virtually identical. Okay?
And
that's
Greek,
incredible
actually,
if they aren't related.
I actually sort of believe that Greek is some sort of Japhethite language.
Yes.
With Hebrew words, a lot of Hebrew words melded into it.
Right, right. Yeah, because the Japhethites had roamed the steppes of southern Russia and migrated up into Europe well before the Israelites did, okay, and the Shemites did. And then they came back, and they founded Venice, okay, and you know more about the Dan and Greeks than I do, you know, all the tribes that were the territories that were founded by the Japhethites in Greece and the Balkans, etc., okay, but those two peoples meshed back together when the Israelites, you know, started going, and of course the Israelites of Judah, such as the Trojans, had wars with the Japhethites, okay? And, the history proceeded in that fashion, and the Celts had wars with the Saxons, but they were all related people, you know? And, since the mainstream historians have no idea that the Saxons, the Brits, the Romans, the Trojans, the Spanish, all et cetera, were all Israelites or Japhethites, in the main Israelites, they simply have no one. They don't even know who the Celts are. They just guess.
Right. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And they don't even have they don't even have the Celts properly identified.
Right.
That they have proto-Celts and Celts, and the proto-Celts got there 1,000 years before the Celts, and they can't figure out how.
Yeah. Right. Because they're all Israelites.
And they have Celtic migrations going from west to east instead of east to west.
Uh-huh. Right. Right. Right, yeah, it's major errors there, major errors. And because, there were Celts who did migrate as far north as the Danube River across the Alps and had settled there, and they were there when the Saxons came.
Well, let me say that the Thracians, Tiras in Genesis chapter 10, that these people they're the original mound builders of Europe. You know, they buried their dead in mounds in Phrygia and all the way up to Sweden.
Yeah.
And these people had been migrating north of the Danube for 1,000 years before the Scythians, before the people that we really know as the Germanic ancestors,
right,
who were the Saka or the Scythians,
yes,
even got to Europe.
Yes.
The Thracians had been inhabiting parts of Europe 1,000 years before and other Japhethite tribes.
Yeah,
they didn't stay in the lands where Genesis 10 might.
And you have these historians, the Russian historians, the Swedish, Danish historians, from that area, refer to these people as the Van or as the Wends or the Veneti. They don't realize that they're Japhethites.
Right.
Yeah.
And the Wends are. They're Slavic Japhethites.
That's right.
And the proto-Celts are actually... So there were Japhethite tribes there first, but they're actually Phoenicians.
Yes.
Who had settled the coast of Europe by sea.
Yes.
They're the proto-Celts.
Right.
And they're split into P-Celts and Q-Celts. And one group settled the coast of Europe by sea. And the other group were the first, they're known as the Kimmeroi, or they're the Cymry.
Yeah.
They're the first wave of Israelite tribes of the deportations.
Yes.
Who crossed Phrygia, destroyed Phrygia, and crossed the Cymry, crossed the Bosporus and into the land about the Crimea and around the Black Sea.
Right.
And they went into Germany. And I've read accounts from scholarly sources saying that the Cymrians disappeared on the Hungarian plains in the 5th century B.C.
Must have been a big old, quicksand.
Well, that's the same time the Gauls, the people the Romans called Gauls, were invading Rome.
Right.
The 5th century B.C. You know, it was like 390 B.C.
So
it was the very beginning of the 4th century B.C.
Mm-hmm.
These Cymrians disappear and the Gauls appear.
Right. Right.
So what's up with that?
Yeah. Well,
and they're the Cymry that crossed into Britain around that same time.
Yeah.
And became amalgamated themselves with the other, the Phoenician and Trojan tribes of Britain.
Right, right. And in the same way that the Israelites disappear from Media, and at the same time, the Caucasians appear on the other side of the Caucasus Mountains. It's like one people completely disappeared, and then a completely different new people miraculously appeared on the other side of the mountains, and they don't make any connection. That's secular history.
Well, why do we have in the 4th, 5th, 6th centuries B.C., we have a land in Spain called Iberia.
Yes.
And in the 4th, 5th, 6th centuries B.C., we have a land the other side of
Yeah.
Of the Caucasus Mountains called Iberia.
Right, right.
And, What's up with that?
Yeah, and you have, what, the Hebrides, the parts of Britain, and Ireland is also called Ibernia. Okay.
Right, and they were all named for the Hebrews.
For the Hebrews, absolutely, absolutely. So
and there's actually, you know, the Malaysians were great settlers, and they are underplayed, even by identity people. A lot of identity people don't understand that they actually settled large parts of the Danube River Valley
mm-hmm.
at an early time. A lot of people that were actually Austrian, Hungarian, German later started out as Malaysians.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, and these people weren't destroyed by the Scythians that came later. The historical record is clear that they amalgamated. They were part of the same race.
Right, right. Yeah, but you know, the Roman period threw all that in confusion because some of the Germanic tribes sided with the Romans against other Germanic tribes, you know, and so there was a lot of confusion there.
Well, those Malaysians are the ancestors of the Hallstatt culture. The Latane culture came actually a little after the Hallstatt culture.
Okay.
And I believe that was the invading, the Cimmerians.
Okay.
But
okay.
The Hallstatt culture and a lot of those people called sort of proto-Celts that supposedly migrated from the west to the east, because everybody knows they were related to the Celts of the West.
Right.
They were actually the Malaysians who settled Ireland and the coast of France and parts of Britain, but
right.
also colonized the Danube River Valley.
Right, yeah, and then groups of them split apart. Some of them sailed further west to Ireland. Some of them settled in Gaul and, you know, became Celts, the Celts of Gaul, okay? And so, yeah, they assumed that somehow there was a west-to-east migration, too, you know. It may have been a minor, you know, there may have been some of that going on, but I don't see any major migrations going west to east from Britain and Ireland to the mainland.
No, it was the same people coming from the Levant and Anatolia
right.
that were colonizing parts of Europe.
Right. And so now, given all this archaeology and the history of how our people settled the Mediterranean basin, the Danube basin, Ireland and Britain and Spain, etc., and you know, we didn't even talk about Northern Africa, but that plays into the picture here, too. These are the people to whom Paul was sent.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no doubt. They're the nations he went to.
Yeah.
The nations actually descended from Abraham.
Yeah. He wasn't sent to non-Israelites, as is commonly supposed, by the false insertion of the word Gentile into the New Testament, or it's in the Old Testament, too. That word has created so much confusion, but because everybody assumes it means non-Israelites, that they, you know, they take that word Gentile and run with it right over the cliff.
Right, and I think we've proven all over and over again that Paul bashers in identity are just idiots.
And so we'll encounter the word Gentile, I think, at least one more time here in Acts 28. And so let's continue now with Acts chapter 28. And when they were escaped, then they knew that the island was called Melita. Okay, we're talking about the Milesians, aren't we? Or is this a different island?
I don't know if Melita, it might be related to the Malaysians, to Miletus in name.
Yeah.
Okay? And it is definitely Phoenician.
Okay.
And it's the island Malta today.
Oh, Malta, okay.
Okay, and I'd like to say a word or two about it.
I see.
Because when we read this account in Acts, because the word barbarian is used,
mm-hmm.
a lot of people envision in their head that they landed on this desert island and met a tribe of savages.
Okay. Right.
Okay.
Right.
And that's what people think of when they read the account in Acts.
Yeah.
Because
they're barbarians, right? Conan the Barbarian.
Well, right. And Luke isn't writing a historiography of the place.
Right.
You know, but Diodorus Siculus did.
Okay.
And Diodorus Siculus says of Melita, and he's writing about 100 years before Luke.
Okay.
Okay? He said that it lies about 800 stages from Syracuse, which is on the coast of Africa.
Okay.
It's a Greek city on the coast of Africa. And it possesses many harbors, which offer exceptional advantages. And its inhabitants are blessed in their possessions.
Okay.
For it has artisans skilled in every manner of craft. And the dwellings of the island are worthy of note, being ambitiously constructed with cornices and finished in stucco with unusual workmanship.
Mm-hmm.
The island is a colony planted by the Phoenicians.
Yeah. Okay.
Who, as they extended their trade to the Western Ocean, found in it a place of safe retreat since it was well supplied with harbors and laid out in the open sea.
Yeah.
And this is the reason the inhabitants of this island, since they received assistance in many respects through the sea merchants, shot up quickly in their manner of living and increased in renown.
Yeah, yeah. So we're talking about Israelites who, you know, built beautiful buildings, had all kinds of trade, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the Jews have never been known.
They've never been known for their exquisite crafts and building beautiful. No,
they never built anything.
They've never built cities.
Except banks.
Right. And we've built the banks for them.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Yeah. We built all the beautiful, oak doors and doorways and the walnut tables, et cetera, et cetera. Okay.
Now, I have a note here that even though these people were, as we can tell from Diodorus' account, quite civilized and cultured,
mm-hmm.
they would be called barbarians, as they are in the Acts account, only because they did not speak Greek.
Right.
That's what barbarian meant.
Right.
Okay.
They were Greeks, yeah.
And from the Augustan age, the word was used by the Romans to describe all tribes which had no Greek or Roman language or accomplishments or didn't engage in Greco-Roman culture.
Yeah.
And so the word does not imply that these people were savages or whatever. And Diodorus actually says they were very advanced.
Yes, yes. Okay, so let me read verse 2. And the barbarous people showed us no little kindness. They were very hospitable, in other words. For they kindled a fire and received us every one because of the present rain and because of the cold. Now, of course, we know, the discussion we just had about the archaeology and the migration, of the area, settlement of the area by Israelites, these people were Israelites. Of course they would have been friendly to Paul.
They just didn't speak Greek.
That's right.
And Paul probably understood their language.
Okay.
I'm sure he did.
Yeah.
And Luke probably did not.
Okay. All right.
Because he was a Greek.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and Paul understood Aramaic, Hebrew, and Greek at least, probably Latin too, because he dealt with the Romans quite a bit.
Right.
So he had to know whatever stage Latin was at the time, hard to say.
But, Latin was a fully developed language by this time.
It was? Okay.
Oh, definitely, but the lingua franca was still Greek.
Yeah.
And Latin was the language of the Roman people. And the Roman government and the army.
Mm-hmm.
However, Greek was even the common tongue on the streets of Rome.
Okay.
In many instances, yes.
Yes. Okay, very good. All right, verse 3. And when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, there came a viper out of the heat. So apparently a viper was bundled into the sticks.
Now the Paul, right, exactly. The Paul bashers slammed Paul even for this.
Yeah.
But it's so obvious that Paul had very poor eyesight.
Ah.
And picking up a bundle of sticks may not see a snake in the sticks. It's
right, right. And it's not a miraculous materialization of a snake.
No, it's a snake in a pile of sticks that Paul happened to pick up.
Yeah, but the King James translation here says it came out of the heat instead of it came out of the sticks.
Well,
yeah.
If you throw the sticks on the fire.
Yeah.
That snake is getting the hell out of there.
That's right.
That's what the Greek says. It came out of the heat.
That's right. And so it's not a miraculous development. It just came out of the sticks, right?
Right.
And fastened on his hand. And when the barbarians saw the venomous beast hang on his hand, they said amongst themselves, "No doubt this man is a murderer, whom though he has escaped the sea, yet vengeance allows not to live." So
now that betrays that these people are just highly superstitious.
Right. They're very superstitious.
If anything bad happens to you, it must be a judgment from God.
Right, or the gods. Yes.
Right.
Yes. Verse 5, and he shook off the beast into the fire and felt no harm. However, they looked when he should have swollen are falling down dead suddenly because he got bitten by a viper, right? You know, why isn't he dying?
Right.
Oh, maybe we're wrong about this guy. But after they had looked a great while and saw no harm come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. So from being a murderer, now he's all of a sudden a god. Verse 7, it's beautiful, the mentality of the change in mentality of the people.
Well, right, and let me just say here, you know, because I've addressed this in my Clayton Douglas replies.
Okay.
The Paul bashers love to point this account out,
mm-hmm.
and contending that Paul never denied their claims. But basically, this is Luke's account.
Yeah.
And just because Luke didn't record any denial, that doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Right.
You know, I'm sure it did.
Right.
We're also told, we're not even told that Paul even heard the claim.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, but remember Acts chapter 14 where certain Greeks made the claim that Paul and Barnabas were gods.
Yes.
And Paul and Barnabas actually rent their clothes and emphatically denied the claim.
Right.
So there's, you know, no reason Paul wouldn't do that here. We're just not told what happened.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and Paul always denied that he was a god. When, you know, so maybe he didn't hear it, or, you know, if you've just been bitten by a snake,
right,
you're glad to have recovered. You don't worry about people say.
Luke's probably observing the bigger picture.
Yeah.
That's all.
Right. Okay, verse 7. In the same quarters were possessions of the chief man of the island, whose name was Publius, who received us and lodged us 3 days courteously. And it came to pass that the father of Publius lay sick of a fever and of a bloody flux, to whom Paul entered in and prayed and laid his hands on him and healed him. So when this was done, others also which had diseases in the island came and were healed. So just like Jesus and the other apostles who had healing powers, so did Paul, verse 10, who also honored us with many honors, and when we departed, they laded us with such things as were necessary. And after 3 months, we departed in a ship of Alexandria, which had wintered in the isle, whose sign was Castor and Pollux.
Now, let me just say, you know, in the ancient world, when you traveled the Mediterranean, these ships traveled as long as they could during the season.
Yeah.
And picked a port to winter in.
Yeah.
Where they wouldn't really travel at all for 3 months. They couldn't. The
okay.
Mediterranean is very rough in the winter.
Okay, very good. Verse 12, and landing at Syracuse, we tarried there 3 days. And from there we circled around and came to Rhegium. And after 1 day, the south wind blew, and we came the next day to Puteoli.
Now, I'm sorry. I said Syracuse was on the coast of Africa before. I'm getting it confused with Utica. Syracuse is the southeasternmost city of Sicily.
Okay.
It's on the southeastern point of Sicily.
Okay.
And Rhegium, you know, he's basically describing the circuit around the island of Sicily.
Okay. Very good.
And the Dioscuri, that actually means sons of Zeus.
Ah.
And they were – that's the name – That's what the word means, and that's the name for Castor and Polydeuces.
Ah, okay.
In legend, they were the twin brothers of Helen of Troy.
Okay.
And they were actually worshipped by the Greeks and the Romans.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we tend to deify people. We still do that today.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right. Verse 14, there we found brethren and were desired to tarry with them 7 days, and so we went toward Rome. And from there, when the brethren heard of us, they came to meet us as far as Epiphorum, and there the three taverns, whom when Paul saw, he thanked God and took courage. Okay. Why would we thank God for three taverns? All right, verse 16.
It's the brethren seeing Paul.
Right.
Gave thanks to Yahweh and took courage. Yeah, well, three taverns, that's actually the name of the town.
Yeah.
And it's named for exactly what it says.
Okay.
I guess, you know, those three taverns were probably a pretty famous place to stop.
Right. Well, like Chicago is named after a stinking onion. Most people don't know that. Okay. Verse 16, and when we came to Rome, the centurion delivered the prisoners to the captain of the guard, but Paul was allowed to dwell by himself with the soldier that kept him. And it came to pass that after 3 days, Paul called the chief of the Judeans together. And when they came together, he said to them, men and brethren, though I have committed nothing against the people or customs of our fathers, yet was I delivered prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans, who, when they had examined me, would have let me go because there was no cause of death in me. But then when the Jews, properly translated here, spoke against it, I was constrained to appeal to Caesar, not that I had anything to accuse my nation of. For this cause, therefore, I have called for you to see you and to speak with you, because that for the hope of Israel, let me repeat that, because for the hope of Israel, I am bound with this claim. As
now, he didn't say Israel and the non-Jews, did he?
No, he didn't.
Or Israel
or
and some
Gentiles. That's right. And we already concluded earlier from our, you know, archaeological discussions, these people were Israelites, right? And Paul knew it.
Absolutely.
Okay? Because that for the hope of Israel, I am bound with this claim. Or chain, rather, sorry. Now, if these were Africans or Chinese or some other race, he would have never referred to them as Israel.
He couldn't have.
He couldn't have. Right. Verse 21. And they said to him, we neither received letters out of Judea concerning you, neither any of the brethren that came showed or spoke any harm of you. But we desire to hear of you what you think, for as concerning this sect, we know that everywhere it is spoken against. And when they had appointed him a day, and I guess he's talking about Christians.
Yes, he is.
Yeah,
and remember, as we had discussed earlier in Acts, now right now it's about 60 A.D.
Okay.
Is the year that Paul arrives in Rome.
All right.
And back in 49 A.D., we had that decree from Claudius Caesar expelling all the Judeans from Rome.
Right.
And that was issued because of all the trouble being caused by the non-believing Judeans
right.
towards the Christian Judeans
right.
in Rome.
Yeah, that's true, but I tend to think that the non-believing Judeans in Rome were actually Jews.
Well, that's right, but I'm calling them all Judeans
right.
just to
remain
historically correct.
Right.
But there's no doubt that most of them are Edomites.
Right, because even Gibbon, in The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, he identifies the Emperor Nero. Nero's wife,
Papagia,
she was converted to Judaism and did their dirty work for him. And she's the one who agitated Nero to start killing Christians. So there were Jews behind that. Okay?
Well, they were, you know, according to Tertullian and Minucius Felix and many of the other early Christian writers of the first and second centuries, Clement, that they all pegged the persecution of Christians on the Jews.
Right. Right. Not on the Romans. It's on the Jews.
All the so-called church fathers identify the Jews as the source of the persecution.
And so the Jews did in Rome exactly what they're doing in America today, turning our own government against us. How about
right,
that?
Right, absolutely.
How about that?
That's the way they act.
That's right. It's happening all over again.
And that, you know, the pattern, and this, one of the things I'd like to say in recap, you know, when we get Acts chapter 4 and 5.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, they actually identified the Sadducees who were persecuting Peter and the other apostles, Peter and John. They actually say, they identify Christianity as a thought crime. Because they tell the apostles, they command the apostles to no longer teach or speak in the name of Christ.
Right.
So right. they're identifying with the Jews of today who consider Christianity to be a thought crime.
That's right. Okay, verse 23. And when they had appointed him a day, there came many to him into his lodging, to whom he expounded and testified the kingdom of God, not the kingdom of Paul. Okay. Persuading them concerning Jesus both out of the law of Moses. Well, I've not been away with folks.
Right. And all the Paul bashers ignore all of the evidence that Paul refutes everything that the Paul bashers assert.
Right.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
The Paul bashers just, they basically follow the Jews.
That's right.
All the Paul bashers, troublemaker.
Well,
they're all pawns of the Jews.
That's right. That because they have, well, but because the reason why they do this is because they don't realize that Judeo-Christianity is a product of Judaism. they just assume that, you know, that the worship of Paul is a Christian thing.
Right.
It's not. It's a Jewish thing.
Judeo-Christianity is the Talmud for Gentiles.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And basically, you know, with the Schofield version of the Bible created by, you know, the Rothschilds. The Rothschilds hired Schofield to produce that annotated version. And that's the first version of the Bible that specifically equated Jews with Israel. Okay. And then, you know, throughout from that point on, you're talking 1900. From that point on to the televangelists, there was a gradual shift in thinking that the Jews are evil to the Jews are God's chosen people. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And Schofield and Bullinger and there's a couple of others that their names are lost to me because I despise them so badly.
Yeah.
And they are Christianity bought and paid for by the Rothschilds.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Samuel Untermeyer and the rest of those, Bernard Baruch, and Jacob Schiff bought and paid for evangelical Christianity.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Because I remember growing up Catholic when I was a teenager in the 50s. We hated Jews. Well, I wouldn't say we hated Jews. We had nothing good to say about them. We made Jew jokes constantly. We were constantly telling Jew jokes all the time. And the nuns and priests didn't object to that.
Well, I learned to hate them from my father by the time I was 12.
Right. So something happened in 1963 when all of a sudden Judaism became a protected class. What do you think happened in 1963? Well, Ron Colley, John 23rd, was a Freemason, which is run by the Jews, folks. That's how the change in attitude toward the Jews came about in the Catholic Church. So let me repeat this. To whom he expounded and testified the kingdom of God, persuading them concerning Jesus, both out of the law of Moses and out of the prophets from morning till evening. And some believed the things which were spoken, and some believed not. Nothing has changed, has it? Verse 25, and when they agreed not among themselves, they departed after that Paul had spoken one word. Well spoke the Holy Ghost by Isaiah the prophet to our fathers. This sentence is very poorly constructed. How do you...
Well, did the Holy Spirit speak through Isaiah the prophet to your fathers? That's what it says.
Right, okay. And then...
And that the received text has our fathers.
Okay.
But the Codex Sinaiticus, the Codex Vaticanus, and the Codex Alexandrinus all have your fathers.
Uh-huh, okay. All right, so...
And it doesn't really matter.
Right, right.
But it's, you know...
Yeah, because we're still talking about Israelites here. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, verse 26, saying... Go to this people. Which people? The whole world?
Right.
Every
all
race?
Going to Israel. He's not
right.
Going to anybody else.
And some of them
are probably Edomites mixed in.
Right.
But they're supposed to reject the word.
Right.
They're never supposed to accept the word. And they're not the focus of this conversation.
Yeah, well, we already know that the Canaanites are excluded.
Right.
So this expression here, this people... cannot mean those Canaanites that have infiltrated
right.
Israel.
This is definitely speaking to Israel.
It's Israel only. Go to this people and say, hearing you shall hear and shall not understand, and seeing you shall see and not perceive. And it's obviously, this is still true today. We have all kinds of Israelites floating around like flotsam on the sea of theology, okay, not knowing who they are. They see, they have eyes but can't see, they have ears and can't hear, and in fact they refuse to hear, and they refuse to see. This is the problem we in identity have. These people are blind and dumb. Verse 27, for the heart of this people is waxed gross, and their ears are dull of hearing, and their eyes have they closed, lest they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and should be converted, and I should heal them. That's the direct quotation, Matthew chapter 13, verse 28. Be it known, therefore, to you that the salvation of God is sent to the Gentiles.
Actually, that's a quote from Isaiah chapter 6.
Oh, okay. Well, then Jesus quotes it also in
Yes. Yeah, it appears about four times in the New Testament. Actually,
right.
It's Isaiah 6, 9 to 10.
Yeah.
But it's also found in Matthew 13, Mark 4, Luke 8, John 12, Romans 11. It's a pretty common, you know, it's an oft-quoted, it's an oft-quoted passage.
So now here, and this is a perfect example of the contradiction here, because verse 26 says, go to this people, Israel. Okay, we're definitely talking about Israel and nobody else. Now, if we assume that the word Gentile in verse 28 means non-Israelites, Isaiah is not talking about non-Israelites. It's talking about Israelites. So if you assume that the word Gentile means non-Israelites, it's a direct contradiction of verse 26.
Right. Paul is basically saying that the nations of Israel.
That's right. That's right. So
this word
Gentile, which the Jews basically invented. I don't know if they talked the King James translators into using it, but apparently it's, you know, since it's a Latin word, which actually means kinsman, okay? So if it's being used of Israelites, it means the kinsmen of the Israelites, not strangers, foreigners, and non-Israelites, as the Jews have defined it. Okay?
Right. I would embrace a commonly understood gentilis.
Right. Exactly.
You know, there's nothing wrong with the word gentilis as commonly that is correctly understood.
Defined by the Latin language, as it means kinsmen.
It's somebody of the same kin. Yes.
Not foreigners, as
somebody
it is understood
of the same
today.
Family.
Right.
And if the gospel went out to the people of the same family, well, it's only for Israel anyway.
That's right. So in verse 28, when you understand that the true definition of the word Gentile is kinsman, it is not a contradiction of verse 26. Okay? So let me read it again. Be it known, therefore, to you that the salvation of God is sent to the Israelite nations, and that they will hear it. And when he had said these words, the Judeans departed and had great reasoning among themselves. And as we did, and this is what I love about Christian identity, we are reasoning among ourselves to get this right. And the Judeo-Christians don't do any reasoning. They just listen to their stupid pastor, most of them who've been trained by the Jews to teach nonsense. Okay? And, you know, we all have differing opinions on various verses, but we're reasoning among ourselves. We're trying to figure this out. The Judeo-Christians are not interested. They're just dogmatists. They're total dogmatists.
Well, that's a sect. It's a cult.
Yeah, they're the ones that are the cult. We're the true Christians. Okay, verse 30 and 31. And Paul went 2 whole years in his own hired house and received all that came into him, preaching the kingdom of God and teaching those things which concern the Lord Jesus Christ, with all confidence, no man forbidding him. So there weren't any Jews, or if there were Jews, they weren't powerful enough to do anything about his preaching and teaching. Okay? And that concludes the book of Acts. So, Bill, I know you want to do a little bit of recap. We've got to have about a half an hour to do that. So why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, well, I think some things are important in the book of Acts to go back over.
Okay.
And the first thing I'm gonna start with, I know is controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my my essay, Baptism in What?
Yes.
I showed at Acts chapter 11, 15 to 16, Peter realized what had happened previously at the home of Cornelius in Acts chapter 10 and related it to the other apostles who were in Jerusalem. And he says, and as I began to speak, the Holy Ghost fell on them, as on us at the beginning. Then remembered I the word of Yahshua, how that he said, John indeed baptized with water, but ye shall be baptized with the Holy Ghost.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Acts 11, 15 to 16.
Right.
And that's, you know, I believe the book of Acts is a book of transition, and the Judeo-Christians that do realize that, that they got the wrong type of transition.
Sure, yeah, they
think it's a transition
from Israel to non-Israel,
Gentiles,
right.
And that's not true at all.
Exactly.
It's rather a transition. It's focused around the reconciliation of the dispersed and true Israel with Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
That's the transition. The transition is from a covenant based on law and sacrifice to a covenant based on the willingness for obedience to the law
right.
and the desire for the mercy of Yahweh.
Right, right. And also the inclusion of the dispersed Israelites with the Judahites.
Right.
Those two are the this is what Paul is trying to explain to these people, that they're all one and the same people, whether they practice circumcision or not.
Right, and it's amazing to me that we don't have a record of it, because I'm sure he had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he had to, at some point in his ministry, point to the one-stick prophecy.
Right.
But we have no record of it, because if we had a record of it, we wouldn't be so blind.
Right.
Even though we have other clear records, you know, like 1 Corinthians chapter 10, where Paul tells the Dorian Greeks that they were part of the Exodus,
mm-hmm.
You know, and things like that. But the book of Acts is also a book of transition away from the ritual sacrifices.
Yes.
Which gives man a false assurance.
Mm-hmm.
And men seek those false assurances.
Right.
You know, some people feel perfectly happy when they're baptized in water by another man, and they receive an assurance that I believe is a false assurance.
Okay.
Because true Christians only need one assurance, and that's the word of Yahweh.
Yeah, as you know, my position on that is that baptism was never part of the ritual sacrifices, so it was not abolished. And I don't see any place in Acts or in any other book where there's a specific commandment that says you shall not baptize.
I believe it's part of the various cleansings that Paul talks about. And the word is baptism in Hebrews.
Yeah.
And it's the same word, baptismos.
Yeah. One of the last commands that Jesus gave was go forth, baptize in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And I don't see any place where that was contradicted. So,
well, it's you know, when Christ stood in towards the end of his ministry, when he was about to be crucified, and it's recorded in Luke, and he says, and it's long after his experience in the Jordan River with John,
mm-hmm.
3 years after. And he says, I have a baptism to be baptized in.
Right, yes.
And that's in his death.
Well,
that, Paul says there's one baptism, and we're to be baptized
mm-hmm.
in his death.
Right. Oh, no doubt. No doubt about that. Yeah. It's just I'm just pointing out that there's no prohibition against water baptism.
There's no prohibition against a lot of things.
Right. Exactly.
But
okay.
We have to recognize that no man, like Pete Peters tells people, you're not going to be saved unless you're baptized by me.
Yeah. Right. Oh, he does.
Yes, he does.
Mm-hmm.
And Clifton Emmaheiser has the testimony, and I think. A few of the Louisiana brethren
do. That's Pharisaism where, you know,
he
you
had one guy actually fly out to his church to be baptized by him because the guy actually believed him.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I know he won't accept baptisms in the name of Yahweh or Yahshua.
and I think that the important thing to realize with the baptism, nothing another man can do for you can earn you your salvation.
Right, exactly.
Period.
Exactly. Yeah.
Only Yahshua Christ has cleansed us.
No,
only Yahshua Christ can deliver us.
And even
that's the way it is.
Yeah, and even when the Levitical priesthood existed, they were only intermediaries. Okay, but Paul clearly says that Yahshua is our only intermediary. He's the one and only intermediary. There's no more intermediary priests. And then the priesthood of the order of Melchizedek is simply the hereditary priesthood of the Adamic people. You know, but we don't save the other Adamites. We don't save ourselves.
No, absolutely not.
Right.
And baptism is yeah, you know, a lot of people see this as being saved at the hands of another man. And
and you know, I certainly don't see baptism in that sense at all. Yeah. I just see it as a rite or ritual that hasn't been forbidden, but it doesn't guarantee salvation. You know,
a lot of things haven't been forbidden explicitly in the New Covenant.
Right.
And that's, you know, the polygamists, that they support their view because it was never forbidden.
Right.
And I admit that it wasn't ever forbidden.
Yeah.
But the perfect, the Christian ideal is to have one wife.
Right.
That's the ideal.
Yeah. Okay. What else?
Acts chapter 2 talks about Christian communion. And when we covered that chapter, I had discussed the difference between socialism and Marxism and Christian communion. And explained that Christian communion is a voluntary taking care of your kinsmen. Where socialist governments and Marxist governments, they are compulsory.
Mm-hmm.
And they are also blind to race. They're blind to a person's behavior. In other words, a Marxist government or a communist government, all races and all types of people participate in it.
Right.
So your money is being redistributed to people without morals.
All types of people besides Jews become slaves of it.
Well, right. Yeah, absolutely.
Jews run it. Yeah.
Right. It's the political expression of Talmudism.
That's right. That's right.
There's no doubt.
Yes.
However, I don't, you know, this Christian community, and I'm trying to stress that it's not communism.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that the Bible upheld that the workman was worthy of his salary.
Right. Right.
And communism determines that the community is worthy of your salary.
Right. And he who does not work shall not eat.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a quote of Paul's.
That's right.
And it's also basically Adolf Hitler said the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and
he was quoting Paul.
He was absolutely quoting Paul. There's no doubt he was quoting Paul.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so there's no possibility that the New Testament or the Bible is communistic in any way, shape, or form. Yeah.
Right.
Many, many denominations teach this.
Well, a lot of communists use Acts or abuse
yes.
Acts chapter 4 to try to support, you know, find
yeah.
biblical support for communism.
Right, right.
But Christian communion is between kinsmen.
Yes.
And it's among those who desire
yes.
the will of God.
Right, and it recognizes the hierarchy of the elders, the workers, the priests, you know, what have you. You know, it does. It's not communistic in political style at all.
No, Paul even upheld property rights even of slave owners.
Mm-hmm.
And Christ upheld the property rights even of slave owners.
Right.
And he didn't require he asked people to go give their belongings to the poor and follow him.
Right, right.
And that's an expression, you know, that would be an exposition of your faith in him.
Right. But here, let's elaborate on that because a lot of people are going to get the wrong impression because under the Old Testament concept of slavery, that was only an institution which was set up for a wrongdoer, someone who had broken the law and victimized somebody to pay back the victim. Okay.
Right, but I mean, revolution says let he who is, you know, more or less preordained to be taken captive, be taken captive.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul actually, his admonishment to slaves
yeah.
was that they should respect their masters.
Right.
And his admonishment to masters was that they better treat their slaves well.
Right, exactly. And
however,
Paul
told the slaves that if they had the ability to be free,
yeah.
to free themselves, they should use it.
Right. It's indentured servitude is what it is. And that means that you're there because you're paying. You either mortgaged your own life away. Okay?
Well, right. That's the Old Testament model of slavery.
Correct? Right, right. And
however, that's not the Greco-Roman model of slavery.
Right. And it certainly, I would say, you know, now given the fact that these people were all Israelites living in their own community, and, you know, you can imagine, let's say, a little old lady having a 300-pound black guy as an indentured slave, okay, that ain't going to work, okay? So we're talking about only Israelites here, and the system was regulated by the Israelites, and so there's no abuses of it, you know. This was, and now every master could free any slave at any time, okay?
Right, it was done all the time.
Yeah, now, try getting out of prison.
Paul asked when he wrote Philemon.
Yeah.
He did it on behalf of a slave.
Yeah.
Who
yeah.
had run away.
Right.
And he told Philemon
yeah.
that he had the authority to command that he free
yeah.
that slave.
It was a
however,
system.
He was asking him to free
right.
that slave.
It was a system of punishment is basically what it was. And now let's bring it up to date. If you had wronged me before you went to prison, okay, and then I forgave you, and I said, I don't want you to be punished anymore, and I told the prison system, I don't want Bill to be punished anymore, do you think that would have had any effect on the prison system?
None whatsoever.
No, because now you're their slave, right? Isn't it slavery?
the prison system in this nation, it is a form of slavery.
That's
there.
Right. That's
and,
right.
And
it's
for
even
some
worse.
Prisoners, it's worse slavery than us.
It's even worse than what's called slavery in the Bible. That's why I want to discuss this more thoroughly. The fact is that the prison system, not just in America, but all over the world, is nothing but slavery. It does not, compensate the victims.
Right. And it's absolutely, and the Hebrew model for restitution compensates.
Yes. They totally ignore the concept of restitution. Once the system gets a hold of the prisoner, the convicted felon or whatever, he becomes the property of the system. It's still slavery, folks. So all these people who want to criticize the Bible because it upholds slavery, they simply don't get it. They don't get it.
No, but it's clear to me that Christ and the apostles recognized property rights. Even
right.
In the context of that culture, even in the case of slaves.
Yeah, okay. All right.
That was a fact, it was the de facto
I just wanted
of the culture, and they upheld that.
Right. I just wanted to point out that the people who criticize the Bible on that count, on the count of slavery, they simply don't comprehend how that system worked and how that it actually compares favorably to the kind of system of punishment we have today. Yeah. Okay.
The Hebrew form of slavery is a lot more just.
That's right.
You were only a slave until the debt was paid.
And then the master could let you go at any time.
Right. There are basically all the forms of punishment in the Old Testament can be boiled down to two:
mm-hmm.
death or reparations.
Right.
If you can pay reparations for the loss of something,
mm-hmm.
then you paid the reparations.
Right. Right.
And if the loss could not be replaced through reparations. Like if somebody killed your brother, then the penalty is death.
Yeah, right, right. Okay, what else? We've got about 15 minutes left. Any other?
Well, I have a lot. It's hard to pick out the most important one, so I'll just go to the next one.
Right.
And that's Acts chapter 5. And there's some distinctions in, I'm sorry, Acts chapter 4.
Okay.
I'll read verse 5. And there was on the next day a gathering of them, the leaders and the elders and the scribes in Jerusalem. This is after they had arrested Peter and John.
Mm-hmm.
And Hannas the high priest and Caiaphas and Johannes and Alexandros and as many as were of the race of the high priest.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay. These are the people who are persecuting the Christians.
Right. Now, here in the King James.
Who were of the race of the high priest.
Right. And the King James says kindred, so it's not a deception here.
Well, right. The word is genos, and it means race.
Yeah. But you have to understand who the kindred and what race they are to understand what's being said here. Absolutely.
Well, absolutely. And in Acts 5:17, we'll see, then stood up the high priest and all those with him, being of the sect of the Sadducees.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody blames the Pharisees for everything.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of bad Pharisees, but there were a lot of good ones.
Yeah.
There were no good Sadducees.
Okay.
And the Sadducees were the people that rejected the entire spiritual world.
Uh-huh.
And there was not one good Sadducee mentioned in the New Testament.
Right, right.
Even though they were good Pharisees.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pharisees they get a lot of flack and they don't deserve all of it because it's clearly the Sadducees who persecuted the Christians the worst.
And
they're the deniers of the spirit.
Yeah.
They deny the spirit, they deny angels, the resurrection, everything to do with the spiritual world.
Well, that's
they're
what the Jews are today. The Jews deny the afterlife.
That's the point I'm going to try to make.
Right.
Because in Acts chapter 4, they basically see Christianity as a thought crime.
Yeah, right.
And they forbid the apostles from even speaking in the name of Yahshua Christ.
Right, right. Anybody who knows the Jews at all knows that they don't believe in the afterlife. All they believe is making money and obtaining power, wealth, and status in this life. That's
these
all
are the liberals, and these are the liberals, progressives of today.
That's
the
right.
ADL, they're the Sadducees of today.
Okay.
The
yes.
Southern Poverty Law Center, they're the Sadducees
of
today.
Yeah, the American Jewish Congress, the World Jewish Congress, all of them, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They're the Sadducees of today.
Very good.
There's no doubt.
Very good.
Acts chapter 9. 9:15. I want to go back over my my translation of Acts 9:15.
Okay.
But the prince said to him, the prince meaning the Kyrios or Christ, go, for he is a vessel chosen by me, who is to bear my name before both the nations and kings of the sons of Israel.
Right, right. Okay, let me read the King James Version, which is not as clear as yours, okay? But the Lord said to him, go your way, for he is a chosen vessel to me to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. So the way this is translated, it's saying, it's making a distinction between, as people understand falsely, the word Gentiles and the children of Israel. Now read your translation again.
Before both the nations and the kings of the sons of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the promise to Abraham, that kings would come out
right.
of the land. And his
right.
descendants would be very many nations.
Yes.
Now the Greek grammatical construction is a hen diatrison, which means one by means of three.
Okay.
That there are Greek constructions that include the conjunction and the article,
okay.
which are used when both entities, and that would be called a hendiadys,
mm-hmm.
or three entities, three named nouns,
yes.
but is called a hendiatrison, which indicate that the writer intends that all three nouns describe the same entity.
Okay. Or of the same entity, yeah.
Yes.
Belonging to the same entity, yeah.
Right. And yeah. here, both the nations and the kings and the sons are all of Israel.
Yes.
They are all the same entity.
Mm-hmm.
The Greek grammar proves that, and that's a hendiatrison.
Yeah.
That's what the construction is called.
Right, right,
and,
right.
And it's very clear that in the Greek grammar that all of the – Paul is saying that he is – you know, Luke is writing, right. I should say – that Christ is saying that Paul will bear his name before the nations of Israel, the kings of Israel, and the sons of Israel.
Right, right. Yeah, and the King James translation here is very deceptive because, number one, the word Gentiles is mistranslated and misunderstood.
Well, so right, and it's oversimplified, and I think it's done
yeah.
simply because they did not realize the impact of what's being said.
Right, right. Exactly, exactly. Fausto is saying in the chat room, I have the Jewish High School Concise Table of Religious Teaching of the Existence of God. Well, they don't deny the existence of God, but what they really teach is that they are God.
Right.
They certainly don't believe in the God of the Bible. Right.
They believe that they are their own Messiah.
That's right.
And they also don't believe in a devil. They don't teach it that there's a devil because they are the devil.
That's right. Why would they admit that? What does the devil say on the witness stand? I didn't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the fact is, despite the fact that their books teach this and teach that, they don't follow it. They do the opposite of what their books teach. They're hypocrites. Beware the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Okay, very good.
Now, I'd like to go to Peter's vision.
Okay.
And no matter what you want to say about Peter's vision, the most important line is in Acts 10:15.
Okay.
And the voice said, and the voice again for a second time to him said, the things which Yahweh has cleansed, you do not deem profane.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most important line in the vision.
Right.
Because when you read right. Peter's vision, you can't assume that anything more is being meant except the things which Yahweh has cleansed.
Right.
And to understand what Yahweh cleansed on the cross,
mm-hmm. right.
one has to go to the Old Testament prophecies.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you won't find anything in any of the Old Testament prophecies about the sacrifice which Yahweh was going to make
yeah.
for the children of Israel that includes anybody but the children of Israel.
Right, yeah. There's no record of him ever cleansing a piece of pork. Right?
Right, or a piece of Negro.
Right. But to me, it's verse 28. And he said to them, you know how that it is an unlawful thing for a man that is a Judean to keep company or come to one of another nation.
And but, that stays. That,
yeah.
Right. But Peter, I don't think, understood that.
But now, but the lesson, here he understands it. But God has showed me that I should not call any man common or unclean. He's talking about Israelites here.
Right. But even that statement, you know, the Judaizers, the Judeo-Christians can pervert that statement.
Yeah, because they generalize the word man, yes.
But they cannot pervert.
Right. Verse 15.
You know, verse 15.
I get it.
Because you have to go back to the Old Testament.
Right.
And see what Yahweh cleansed.
Yeah, and he never cleansed a piece of pork on a dish. There's no way.
Right. Yeah, there's no. This isn't talking about food by any means. It's talking about people.
That's right.
And it's only talking about Israelite people.
Right.
Because they're the only people that ever received that promise of cleansing.
That's right.
There's nothing in the Old Testament prophecies in Isaiah, Jeremiah,
mm-hmm.
Hosea, where it talks about this sacrifice that Christ was going to make.
Right.
That portends anybody but the children of Israel.
Well, Bill, the fact is the Judeo-Christian world recognizes what you're saying. Because why? Because they call all the so-called grafted-in races spiritual Israel.
Right, a phrase that doesn't exist anywhere in the Bible.
Right.
And they pollute the minds of the people with things that don't exist in the Bible.
So you're absolutely right about verse 15. They cannot twist and distort that verse. But if they teach that it's about food, you know, and ignore verse 15...
Well, they ignore verse 28.
They ignore verse 28, too.
You know, teaching
exactly
it's
right.
about food. It's definitely about men.
That's right. Right. They ignore verse 28 because it proves that the whole episode is talking about men, not meat. Okay? And they ignore verse 15 because it proves that God only cleansed one particular people. Yeah. It's beautiful. Once you understand the New Testament and who it's addressed to, and who it's written by, okay, and who it's about, there's no confusion. There's absolutely no confusion. But the churches have become so corrupt in their antinomianism and their vague generalizations and their faulty understanding of numerous words such as Gentile and grafted in. And, you know, in fact, that grafted in episode is only talking about Israelites that, I'm sorry, Adamites, who were not part of Israel being grafted in, right? That's not talking about other races. Isn't that what that episode's about?
In Romans chapter 11, the grafting in only has to do with the Romans.
Right.
Paul never uses that analogy in any of his other epistles.
Okay.
When Paul addresses the Corinthians, he tells the Corinthians that their ancestors were in the Exodus and baptized in the cloud and the sea
right.
with Moses.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, the Romans were different. The Romans were different because the Romans' ancestors were the Trojans. The Trojans' ancestors were Zara Judah.
Right.
Where the Corinthians were Dorian Greeks.
Yes.
The Corinthians' ancestors came to Greece from Palestine after the Israelites settled Palestine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Zara-Judah branch left from Egypt before the Exodus.
Before the Exodus, right. So they had to be grafted in, but they were still Israelites.
They were wild olives because they did not have
the
law and the prophets at Mount Sinai.
Yeah. And then another generalization they make is where the Bible talks about Yahweh is no respecter of persons. They totally misrepresent that as meaning to include other races.
That has nothing to do with race.
That has
everything to do with status.
Right.
It only has to do with status.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
best place to go to address that is James chapter 2.
Okay.
And there are other places in the Old Testament that say basically the same thing, but, you know, this is off the top of my head. James chapter 2 explains and uses the same words Paul makes. The word is It's pros opalatia, which means receiving the face of persons.
Okay.
Okay? Or receiving, I translate it, receiving the status or stature of persons.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay? And James uses the same word,
mm-hmm.
pros opalatia, and
right.
that word he uses to describe the difference between a rich man coming into your assembly and a poor man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not to respect the wealthy just because they're wealthy.
Right.
And that's what that word means. It has everything to do with the status of person,
yeah, not
of
the race.
Persons, and nothing to do with race.
Absolutely nothing to do with race. Thank you very much. Okay. So this book of Acts, properly understood, proves the exclusivity of Israel without any doubts. Without
over
any
over
doubts
again.
Whatsoever.
Over and over again. And,
yeah.
And I mean, I have a whole long list of verses, but we'll cut it at this.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And,
yes.
And I'll save these notes. Well, it's all a part of my,
okay,
you know, presentation all the time anyway.
Yeah, right. Well, Bill, all I have to say is well done. It was an extreme pleasure to go through the book of Acts and get the history right, get the racial identities correct, and the teachings correct, you know, and all of these myths that the Judeo-Christians have created around the book of Acts have all been demonstrated to be false, every last one of them. And so I thank you for helping me to demonstrate that. Thank you all for listening and joining us for these lectures and presentations on the book of Acts. I think where are we going to go? We're going to go back to 2 Corinthians next week. Is that what you want to do?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to get back to Paul.
Okay.
And keep pounding on the Paul bashers because they're a bunch of damn fools.
Yes.
And thank you and praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh, and we'll see you next Saturday night. We'll start into 2 Corinthians. My guest tomorrow, scheduled guest, is Barbara Lowe Fisher, the founder of the National Vaccine Information Center. And that'll be 11 o'clock Central, 12 noon Eastern. Looking forward to doing that interview. See you tomorrow. Yah bless, everybody.